Welcome to the Writer's Weekly Podcast, a forum geared toward the writing enthusiast and those who want to make money from their writing. I'm Brian Whidden, Managing Editor of Writer's Weekly, and I'll be your host along with Angela Hoy, the creator of Writer's Weekly and President and CEO of BookLocker.com, a full-service book publishing company. Whether you want to learn how to become a professional writer, how to find writing gigs, or even publish your own book, then you come to the right place. We'll be discussing all kinds of topics relating to the writing and publishing industries. Don't forget, you can also click over to writersweekly.com. There, you'll find not only thousands of articles about professional writing, you can also find current paying markets and job listings to help you boost your writing career and even your bottom line. But for now, let's get on to this episode of the Writers Weekly Podcast. And welcome back to another episode of the Writers Weekly Podcast. With me today, again, Angela Hoy.
I'm here.
We have had a heck of a week.
You could say that again. Heck of a lot of not sleeping.
Yeah, that's true. So anybody that's been following Writers Weekly and this podcast, you know we lost our rooster last month to an unknown predator. We decided we needed a new rooster for the little farm we live on here, and we decided to attempt to incubate and hatch 12 eggs. Angie, you want to take it from there?
Well, you know, we were hoping we'd get, you know, one or two, maybe a hen and a rooster. But as of today, we have 7 little chicks hopping around in a little tote with their food and their water and the heat lamp. And getting them all cracked open, of course, all but one did it by themselves, was mayhem.
I think we could literally say that anything that could have gone wrong did go wrong on this.
Yeah, the first one, it was upside down in the egg, right?
His head was on the wrong end of the egg. Yeah. Yep.
So he was having a hard time turning himself around because they pick a circle around the egg and then the egg, you know, cracks open.
He was 3 days early.
Yeah.
So and we thought he was going to be like a what would you call that?
Special.
A preemie chick, I guess?
Yeah, he was having a hard time, so you had to help out with, and everywhere online it says don't help them, but this one clearly needed help, and you helped a little bit, you kept the membrane intact, but you kind of helped it where he could move around a little bit, cracked open the shell
just a little
bit.
Just little cracks here and there, pick a little shell, leave it, put it back in the incubator, wait for hours, and then he still wasn't making any progress.
And then, of course, you know, I was on chick sitting duty and you went to church on Sunday and I checked again and it was still, the little hole was maybe a half inch wide and his little beak was poking out. He could breathe.
And this was, we were going on over 24 hours at this point, like almost 36 hours.
Yeah. And so we were thinking he wasn't going to make it, or she. And then I went and took a shower and 30 minutes later I walked into the kitchen and I saw this black blob. He had successfully completely gotten out of that egg within 30 minutes, and he was kind of laying on the floor of the incubator. His head was on the floor. I could see he was breathing. He was all wet. I had never done this before, and of course, you weren't here, so I called you, and I said, he's out. What do I do? Do I lick it? Am I supposed to lick it?
Well, I didn't really know what to do either. I'm just willing to take a chance. I mean, that's really, I'm no expert at this. I watched my dad raise a lot of birds, and I guess some of that came back to me. But for the most part, I was winging it.
Yeah, so I just left it alone and waited till, you know, you got home. And then
so after that, in fact, by the time that one hatched, I think we had like, what, 4 or 5 more that had cracks in them, pip holes.
While you were at church, I looked really close, and 5 more eggs had these little tiny cracks, and I knew that they were coming along. And I'm thinking, you know, remember we wanted like 1 or 2, and I'm like, uh-oh.
And so we kept wanting to watch one hatch, but I mean, they take literally, when they make that first little crack in the egg, they wait almost 8 hours. They just rest, and they're breathing air at this point now. They got air coming into the egg.
Now, this was Sunday.
Yeah.
Sunday evening, our son Max and his friend Caleb came over. Caleb's in the Army, and they were oohing and aahing about, you know, all the little, because you can hear them peeping in the eggs.
Yeah.
And they move. The eggs move, you know, before they really get big cracks in them. Yeah. And so that was a pretty good show. And then we were all sitting on the back porch, and we came in because the guys were about to leave, and Max went, oh, look, there's another one.
Yeah.
So once again, we're not looking, and one completely breaks out of its
egg. It's like
they
constantly waited until we weren't looking.
Yeah.
Well, so you got that other one before we all kind of went to bed, and I tell you, it is, when they say, put a heat lamp up there for them, it's not that simple.
No.
You have to maintain a certain temperature, according to everything that I've read. And trying to maintain a steady temperature with a dang heat lamp
hanging over the thing.
We had to take one of our microphones from the studio. We hung the heat lamp from it so I could adjust height and angle and
that
all
was
this stuff.
Brilliant idea.
I had purchased like six little miniature thermometer / hygrometer.
Little
thermometers,
bitty things, little bitty
to put in that box with the birds so that I can monitor what the temperature. We were in there every 30 minutes.
Seemed like we were in there
adjusting
for
24 hours. Stupid light. And I actually wound up sleeping in that room for half the night to continue to check it. I mean, I got no sleep for like 2 days.
Yeah.
And I finally, it was like the room was like 90 degrees. And
oh,
I'm like, okay, I've had enough of this. It's like 3 a.m. I'm like, I'm going back to my bedroom. These chicks are laying here sleeping. They clearly enjoy this heat. I'm getting the hell out of here. I'm walking back and I'm hearing thump, 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 cheep, 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 thump, 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 cheep, cheep, coming out of the, incubator. And I look, I'm like, well, what do you know? There's three more. So I wake you up at 3 a.m. because, I mean, if I'm up, you need to be.
We got three more, right?
And she's like, oh, my gosh. And she runs in there. We're looking at, there's these things tripping all over each other and everything. Mm-hmm. So there was, so there's what, five.
Mm-hmm.
And then at some point, another one, it's all a blur to me at this point because, like I said, I'm like sleep deprived.
Right. The next morning we had another one break out.
And so it was Monday that the grandkids came over.
Yep. Monday they came over and got to witness the miracle of life.
The very last one actually started hatching in front of our grandkids, and we all sat for about a good hour and a half watching this thing, and we were there when he finally,
we had the grandkids on chick watch.
Yeah.
We were positioning, they were taking turns sitting there staring at the incubator because we didn't want to miss it.
Yeah.
And it's good. We didn't miss it because that was the last one that hatched. With the others were duds.
I'm sorry. Go ahead. Keep going.
No, the others were duds.
Yeah.
And then I walked over there and I noticed it was coming. It was coming fast. So I positioned my phone and I just started recording it. And every minute I would start re-recording it so it wouldn't be, you know, like 25 minutes long. And we got it on
video.
I was going to say on film. Huh? And that just aged myself.
Yeah.
And I put it on Facebook. So if you go to Facebook, go to, you know, Angela Hoy on Facebook and look back on Monday evening, you can see the recording of the chick hatching, and the grandkids were just mesmerized. They were so quiet and calm, and they just watched and watched. Oh, it was amazing. It was really cool.
I know there's plenty of y'all out there that probably do this regularly and like, what are they going on about? This is our very first time.
Yeah,
We've never done this before. We were actually shocked that we had 7 out of 12.
Yeah.
That's a much better success rate than we were expecting.
Yeah. Now we're like, what do we do with all of them?
We had the first one, which was 3 days early, upside down. We didn't think he was going to make it.
Yeah.
We had one who came out with curled toes, and that is a deformity that can happen if they're positioned wrong or if they're in that egg too long or whatever, and they come out and their toes are kind of cockeyed to the side. So I had to fix his little toes
with
medical tape.
I had
and
to
make
hold him
little
upside
like
down.
Little casts to spread his toes out and make and tape them like that, and he had to spend 3 days like that until his bones would harden up,
he was stomping around it because it's little tiny pieces of tape just wrapped bottom and top, and he was stomping around like he was wearing
snowshoes.
Snowshoes. It was hilarious.
And then the last one after it, I mean, it it hatched in record time. I mean, it took no time for this thing to work itself out of that shell. Now, it pipped. It made that first little crack. It waited about 8 hours. And then I think it only took about an hour, hour and a half to fully get out of that egg. Sometimes mm-hmm. it can take them a good 4 or 5 hours just to get out of that egg. So we're thinking, great, yeah, this one's perfect. But then it's like, it just wouldn't get up and move around. It was just laying there.
And I kept checking. It was still breathing. I could still see it breathing, but it wasn't moving at all. It would occasionally pick its head up and lay it back down, you know, plump it back down.
So and we're preparing ourselves to lose this one.
And we're trying to figure, you know, he doesn't appear to be drying out because he's not moving around. The other ones would immediately hop around for a minute and then take a 10-second micro nap. Yeah. I'm not exaggerating. They would close their eyes for 10 seconds, get up, and start hopping around again. This one just wouldn't get up. And then we're like, oh, we don't think this one's going to make it. So you went to bed.
I had to go to bed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I stayed up, and I just happened to get on Facebook and explain, we've got this chick that won't get up and move around. You know, its head's on the ground. What do I do? And one of my readers directed me to an article, and it's called What to Do with a Lethargic Chick. And the second comment under the article said, people call me crazy, but I turned the incubator heat down to 90 to 95 degrees. Now we'd had it at 101, and that worked for all the other chicks.
Mm-hmm.
So I got Brian up and I said, show me how to lower the temperature on this thing. You have to push several buttons, and I'm not that technical. And he lowered it to 95, went back to bed. And I kid you not, within 1 minute, that chick stood up and started hopping around.
Yeah.
It was just, we were baking him and we didn't know it. And a couple hours later, he was all fluffed up and I moved him into the tote with the other ones. And and then I laid in that 90 degree room for 2 hours, checking on him for every 15 minutes. And then after 2 hours and he was still hopping around and nobody was picking on him because they do peck at each other. Then I got up and went back to our room where the air conditioner was working just fine. So that was our adventure. And now now they're in the garage.
Mm-hmm.
And they're growing so fast, and they're adorable,
mm-hmm.
and I'm hoping they're not all roosters.
Oh, I doubt they're all roosters, but I'm pretty sure one of them is, because it's that yellow one. Mm-hmm. He's already starting to jump in the air, flap his wings, and tackle other birds.
Oh, yeah, that's probably him.
And, I mean, they don't have really a lot of feathers, but he's already figuring out, if I jump and flap my wings, something should happen.
Yeah.
About a week old now? Less than a week old.
Yep,
4 days, basically.
Well, depending on which one we're talking about.
Yeah. But, so we're hoping one of these is going to be a rooster to replace Randy. The rest can be hens. That's fine. If we have two roosters, we're just going to have to figure that one out.
Well, we can either, you know, get on the neighborhood Facebook group, Dade Helps or whatever, and ask if anybody needs a rooster. And if we don't have any takers, well, I've heard they taste just like chicken.
They taste like chicken.
Yeah, so I'll be inside on that day if you need to cull the herd.
So anyway, that's our home office story for this week. Mm-hmm. Stay tuned. We will keep
you
up to date on what goes on with these birds. They are never boring. That's one thing we've learned about chickens.
Oh, and our dog Moon is very sweet with them. We have to keep our dog Tank away because if he just hears them chirping, he starts licking his chops.
Tank thinks they are nuggets.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Yes. Bad boy.
All right. So that's, again, stay tuned. We will keep you up to date on what goes on with the chickens. So on today's episode, we have one of our own authors. His name is Gary Sturgis. And Gary is a grief specialist, coach, speaker, and a bereavement facilitator. And his life was profoundly impacted when he lost his spouse to stage 4 metastatic melanoma in 2014. And because of this loss, he authored the book Surviving, Finding Your Way from Grief to Healing, and he launched his website called Surviving Grief, and that's www.sgrief.com, sgrief.com, and his Facebook page called Surviving Grief, which now boasts over 340,000 followers.
Wow.
Gary is now recognized as one of the world's leading voices in grief and loss. He helps thousands of people navigate their grief, and he's now authored 4 books, including his international bestseller, Surviving Grief, 365 Days a Year. And Gary has touched many lives as a creator and the founder of Surviving Grief LLC. He provides the support and resources needed to support those who have lost a loved one. Gary, welcome to the podcast. First and foremost, sorry for the loss that you went through, but you clearly made something really good out of it. And we're very proud to have you as part of the Book Locker family.
Well, thank you very much. It's good to be a part of that family.
So for starters, I just wanted to let you talk about, you know, where this all started. You went through a tragic incident, and like I said, you grew it into something really, really special. Would you like to just share with us a little bit about what, you know, what all happened?
Sure. So after losing my spouse back in 2014, I was looking for resources and support for my grief, and there really was just very little out there available to me. So I felt very alone in my sorrow, and I didn't want anyone else to feel the way that I did. And so I decided that, you know, I needed to provide support and resources for people like myself that were grieving the loss of a loved one. And someone suggested, you know, at the time I was seeing a grief counselor, and she suggested that maybe I should write my story and share that with other people. And at the time, when she asked me to do that, I was only about a year out in my loss. And I said, you know, I don't think I want to do that because the book is probably going to be just all sadness. And I'm sure people grieving don't need, you know, my sadness on top of their own. So I waited a couple of years and then I wrote it after I was starting to heal because I wanted the book to, you know, kind of reflect my journey from my loss and the sadness in the beginning and then move forward into a place where I was getting to a place of healing, and I thought it would make more sense. And, you know, interestingly enough, when I wrote my first book and I published it through Book Locker, you know, I didn't think that anyone would read it. You know, I thought, well, I'll do this. And it was therapeutic for myself. And I didn't think, you know, I thought, well, if a couple of people read it, great. If they don't, well, it's therapeutic for myself to write it. But, you know, it was somewhat of a perfect storm because the year it came out was also the year COVID hit. And so I think at that point when COVID was hitting and so many lives were lost, people were looking for resources like my book. And so my book kind of took off because of that. So it was, it was kind of like a perfect storm.
Definitely created a demand. Interesting that you say you didn't want to write the book right away because you were in that bad place. You were still just kind of wallowing in the loss. But again, isn't that officially like one of the, I guess, stages of grief? I mean, you kind of have to go through that to get to that next point.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, I wanted to reflect in the book that there is a next point, though. You know, it was important for me not to have the book just be all the pain and sorrow. I also wanted it to be the transition to, you know, thinking about your loved one with more love than pain. And so yeah. I needed my own time to experience that in order to share that with my readers.
Yeah.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah. And I scanned over your books a little bit, and I could definitely tell that loss was devastating to you. And it took you a while to kind of transition to that next place.
I want to point out that, sure. When you first submitted your manuscript to me, I knew it was going to take off, and I lost my dad during COVID. He didn't die from COVID, but he had a blood clot, and he had a stroke. It was Black Friday during COVID, and that was around the same time that you contacted me first.
Interesting.
So thank you.
You're welcome. Mm-hmm.
So. Of course, the general topic of all of your books is grief and dealing with the loss of life. You've got four books out. Mm-hmm. If you'd like to name them and just give me an idea of the focus of each one.
Sure. So the first book I wrote is called Surviving, Finding a Way from Grief to Healing. And that book is somewhat autobiographical. I share my story with the reader and how I process my grief. And what resources worked for me, and more importantly, what resources didn't work for me, you know, and I think that was important for me to express that to my readers. And then my second book, Grief, Hope, and the Aftermath, that book was born from the work I was doing as a grief group facilitator. I wanted to share with the reader the lessons and insights I learned from the members of my groups. So each chapter in that book is about some aspect or experience of grief and loss. And at the end of each chapter, I interviewed a member from one of my groups that had that particular experience on their own grief journey, and I asked them to share their story. And so that book is, I like to call that more of a practical book on grief and loss. It kind of gives the reader, you know, information on the aspects of grief and the stages, you know, the different stages that you go through, and just to give them some practical advice on how to deal with their grief and loss. And then my third book is the book that I have that has become the best-selling book that I've written is Surviving Grief 365 Days a Year. And I wrote this book because grief doesn't take a day off. And mm-hmm. so most grief books you can read in a day or a week, and then you're done. But this book provides the reader a daily reflection on grief and loss so they can read the book for the whole entire year. And it's a daily companion for them when they need it most, which is really every day, you know. And so I think that's one of the reasons why that book has been doing so well. And then the last book I wrote is the Surviving Grief Workbook, which is somewhat of a companion to the 365-day book, because it's my belief that in order to heal from a loss, you have to do what I call the grief work. And that requires thinking about and writing about the emotions and feelings you're experiencing and finding ways to remember your loved one with more love than pain. The workbook gives them the tools they need to do that. And it's interesting because I'm also a grief coach. And so when I work with my clients one-on-one, counseling them through grief coaching, I give them what I call homework. And a lot of the homework that I gave them, they would say to me like, oh, you know, that homework you gave me really, really helped. You know, a lot of times they were writing assignments or they were like reflective kind of, you know, exercises I would have them do. And so they were giving me so much great feedback about how much these coaching homework assignments I was giving them was helping them that I decided to just put them all in a book. And so that's basically what the Surviving Grief Workbook is. There's also practical advice. I do share a little bit about my own experience and what I did that helped me to do that grief work, and then include the exercises at the end of each of those chapters in that book. So I think that book has, you know, is already starting to do really well, because I think a lot of people do want to be able to work their way through grief and have the tools they need to do that.
I think adding a workbook to complement the 365 days book was a fantastic idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was actually going to say that too, but yeah, because it's one thing to just read a book and take in information, but to have a structured set of activities to do that get your brain gears going, I think that's a definite advantage towards moving on and growing, I think.
Right. And you know, I call it a companion to the Surviving Grief 365 Days a Year book because, you know, I let my readers know that if you're reading that book every day, you know, you're kind of getting these different aspects and feelings and emotions each day of the year. And so the workbook, if you're doing that in tandem with the 365 book, then it has more of an impact. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And it's like with a daily passage for that grief, it, you know, after 360 days, there's no, or 365 days, there's nothing wrong with going back and starting again, because you've probably forgotten that first one and just go through it again until you get where you need to be.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's interesting because a lot of the feedback, emails and things that I get from readers of the 365 book, they'll tell me, you know, I bought your book when I was in my first year, and I'm starting it over again this year, now going into my second year, because I think I, you know, am going to gain different, you know, different insights from it this second year around. And a lot of people do that. A lot of people tell me they're even in that they're reading it for like the third year. You know, it's like they just find it to be, you know, you're in a different place. And so some of the things you read in that book are probably going to affect you a little differently. You know, something that doesn't resonate with you now is going to resonate with you down the road on your grief journey.
Oh, that's awesome.
That's really interesting. I'm going to swing off topic a little bit here for a second and go into the personal. And I was going to ask you a question about this. I lost my father back in 2013, and it's like, it's weird because things that didn't even affect me back then or the years, you know, for years afterwards, I'll be doing something even now, I mean, in the last year and say, boy, I wish Dad could have seen me doing this. He'd be so proud. You know, he'd really like to see what I'm doing right now. And it hits. It's like, he's not here anymore. My father passed from pulmonary fibrosis, which basically it's your lungs start growing a bunch of scar tissue and eventually they just can't take in oxygen anymore. So like cancer, we had to sit and watch him go through this. And deal with the fact that he's going to go and it wasn't going to be a very comfortable going for him, unfortunately. And at the point when he's gone, yes, there's a sadness for the loss, but there's that combination of thank God it's over. And with that comes a guilt that you're feeling like this. Is that something you run into a lot from people who have, you know, not had a sudden loss, but actually watched somebody pass from a medical condition?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, my spouse died from metastatic melanoma, stage 4metastatic melanoma, which I always say is just a fancy word for really, really bad cancer.
That's skin cancer, so, right?
Yeah, and so it just metastasized, though, to everywhere. And so... Mm-hmm. Being a caregiver, it's really difficult. You know, it's extremely difficult to watch someone you love suffer and wither away and be in pain even, you know. Yeah. And so that's difficult. And I lost my dad, August will be 4 years, and he died from congestive heart failure. You know, we had to put him in a facility and he never wanted to go in a facility. So there's the guilt of that. You know, he would always say to me, don't ever put me in one of those places, you know, and then you just don't have a choice, you know. And so there's so much guilt with that. And, you know, one of the things I tell the people I work with when they ask me the question you just asked me is that, you know, you have to kind of remind yourself that you did the best you could with the knowledge you had at the time. And so you can't live the rest of your life. You know, this person knew you loved them and you know that person loved you. And that person knows that you did everything in your power to help them and make their transition as easy as possible. And the bottom line is we as a society and we as human beings believe that we have so much control over everything. And that's why when people lose someone they love, there's so many, I should have did this and I could have did that and I would have did that. And I call them the woulda, coulda, shoulda. And we play those over and over in our head, you know, sometimes for the rest of our life. And I think it's really important to just say, you know, I loved this person. I did the best I could with the knowledge I had at the time. And, you know, life is random, you know, and I always say we all have an expiration date. You know, we're all going to go and we all don't know how we're going to go. And, you know, we hope it's an easy way. I mean, I hope it's in my sleep, you know, having a dream and off I go. But that's not the way life is. And so, you know, I think letting go of that guilt and kind of letting go of, you know, our own guilt, like giving ourselves some a sense of peace for and grace for ourselves to say, you know, I did the best I could, and that person knows I love them, and yeah,
that is great advice.
Yeah, and I think that is something that people definitely needed at the time of COVID, because we got hit with this thing that nobody understood, and they were watching their loved ones. Sometimes go slowly, but sometimes go just, you know, you wouldn't expect it. I can say the one thing I've become very grateful for is I thank God that we had the time to say things that needed to be said, Before my father passed, we were one of those families where, there wasn't a lot of touchy-feely, I love you kind of stuff, you know. So to be able to, you know, say things that needed to be said before he went, I think meant a lot to all of us. So that was, you know, but great, great advice. So
I also got to say goodbye to my dad.
Yeah.
He had a stroke. They took him to the hospital. He never wanted to be on a ventilator. Put him on a ventilator. My brother is a pastor, and he went the next day. They were going to unplug my dad, and he held the phone up to my dad's ear, and I got to say goodbye to my dad. That was the hardest conversation I've ever had, but I'm so blessed that I got to have it.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
So you wrote that first book, and then I guess it was after the first book you decided to go into the coaching role. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I'd love to hear about just the thought process and the feelings you were going through that made you think, wow, there's more to this than just writing a book. There's more I can do to be helping people. Can you talk about that?
Sure. The coaching came out of two things, really. It came out of my book, and it also came out of my work being a bereavement facilitator for support groups. The reason being that people that have lost a loved one that read one of my books or were a member of one of my support groups would ask me if I did one-on-one counseling. And that was how I decided to train to be a grief coach, because I know that not everyone is a grief group person. You know, some people are introverts. They don't like to talk in a group of people. They don't like to share personal information in a group. And so a lot of times in the group, people would come up to me at the end of the group and say, you know, do you ever work with anyone on one-on-one? And I wasn't doing that. And so I decided that that was a much needed resource, and that I had gained, you know, a lot of knowledge, not only from writing my books, but from facilitating groups for so many years. You know, I had just picked up a lot of information. And so I knew that I could share that with people on a one-to-one basis. And it really, I at this point, I'm turning away clients because I just have too many of them. So there's a need, there's a need, and people are looking for it. And, you know, there's a big shortage right now of grief counselors as well, you know. And so the grief coaching field, when I got on it, was at a point where they were really looking for grief coaches, you know, because the counselors were just overwhelmed, I think, you know, because of COVID and just everything that's kind of going on in the world. There's just a lot of collective societal grief. And without the resources of having enough counselors, people were then turning to coaches.
I think it's interesting that you were involved in the industry and then you found out from your clients additional services that they needed that you could provide. We were talking yesterday about, you know, I started out writersweekly.com, and pretty soon people were sending me questions, the same questions over and over again, and I would turn around and write a book about that. I didn't even know there was a need for it. So you basically did the same thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's put some numbers to these facts here, because I know I was going over some of your articles that you've written for us in writersweekly.com. Mm-hmm. And I noticed one of the, I guess, online groups that you do, you're up to like, well, at the point you wrote that article, you were up to like 450,000 members. I'm not sure which group that was.
Are you talking about my Facebook page?
It might be the Facebook page.
Probably the Facebook page. I mean, overall, my social media following, you know, counting like Instagram and Twitter and all that kind of, is getting pretty close to 500,000, you know. Wow. So it's just grown and grown.
That is amazing.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I'll be honest with you. I went on a trip to Aruba, and somebody was like, you know, aren't you Gary Sturgis from Surviving Grief? I was in the supermarket and it happened, and I was like, oh, I guess I'm becoming well known, you know, because people are actually starting to come up and say like, oh my God, I know who you are. You know,
that is fantastic. You're helping so many people.
Yeah. And what other, so you've got your Facebook group. What other social media do you have going on? What kind of numbers are you looking at? I mean, because it looks to me like there's a lot of people seeking answers for their loss.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll be honest with you. You know, I'm on Twitter. I'm on Instagram. I have my website. I focus mainly on Facebook because my Surviving Grief Facebook page is really what brought me like the notoriety. And so because that's so well known, it's word of mouth now. You know, I think people just say, oh, you should go to Facebook and follow this guy, Gary Sturgis, because the Facebook page, the more it grows, the more administrative work I have to do. The more I can spend a whole day just answering hundreds of emails too, you know.
Oh boy.
So it's very laborious, I guess, you know. And so I was given the advice by someone that said, you know, focus on one, you know, try not to focus on all four of these different platforms, like pick one that's working for you and focus on that. And of course, you know, all this does trickle down back to book sales as well, you know. And so my books sell from my Facebook page because that's what I'm well known for. I have a strong social media following on particularly Facebook, and so I focus mainly on that.
Mm-hmm. I can tell you that we track all of the traffic coming to our websites, and Facebook is by far the number one driver sending people to our websites.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Of course, my primary goal here is to help other authors discover ideas for marketing their books and increasing their sales. But it wasn't until I was writing out my recording notes here, I didn't really appreciate the tightrope I'd be walking when we got to this part, because I know you didn't write these books just to sell books. It's clearly that this came from your heart and you wanted your words to help and heal people. However, in order to do that, you do have to sell the books, and your services. You have to sell your events, your counseling service or your coaching services. And without that, people don't get your help. So sometimes I think authors don't like marketing or trying to get people to buy their books, because by and large, it is a product of their passions and their experiences or their imagination in the case of fiction. And that's sacred to most people. But I think many feel like the marketing process sort of cheapens their work to some extent. Where do your thoughts fall on the marketing process for your books and your services?
So it's interesting you ask that, because, you know, when you're dealing with the topic of grief, it's really difficult. And I'll give you an example of that. You know, this is a true story. Someone said to me when I published Surviving, my first book, they said, you know, your book is a self-published book, and the statistics say that if you sell 200 copies of a self-published book in the lifetime of the book, you've done well. Well, I've far, far, far surpassed that, you know.
Yes, and so, you have.
Yeah, and so I never expected that. However, that being said, I at one point in time got a kind of, and I get them all the time. I mean, I'm putting myself in a public arena and I expect to get backlash sometimes. Even a person who's helping grieving people gets hate mail. And so someone had sent me an email and said, you know, I think it's terrible that you are making money. You know, you are trying to sell your books and make money off of people that are grieving. That's horrendous and terrible. Okay. And so I'm a sensitive person, and that really hurt me. I thought, you know, this is not what it's about. This is me trying to get my book into the hands of people that need it. I mean, when I was grieving, I read grief books, and I was happy about those books. And I was happy when someone said to me, hey, Gary, you should read this book. You know, I lost my spouse and it really helped me, and I think it will help you. I appreciated that. And so that really hurt me. So I reached out to another author, a very well-known author. You probably have heard of David Kessler. And yeah. I said, this person said this to me, and I'm really hurt. And the advice that I was given was that he said, you know, there's always going to be people that feel that way about it. And if people don't know who you are, and they, you know, say something like that, then they clearly don't know what your heart is like and what kind of person you're like. So you can't take that to heart. And I remember really appreciating that feedback, because what I found, one of the reasons, and I've had other authors, I have authors all the time come to me, especially authors that write books about grief and loss, that come to me that want to collaborate and want me to tell them what my marketing strategies are and why my books are doing so well. And a lot of them say to me, you know what? I think your books sell so well because people just like you. You know, they trust you and they know what you're saying is coming from your heart. And this all falls back with the fact that I write a daily blog on Facebook, and there are people that are grieving that get up every morning, and I get hundreds of emails saying, like, my day starts with you. I get up, I make my cup of coffee, I open my Facebook page, and I read your daily blog, and I don't know what I would do without being able to do that. And
That
that
is so
person,
sweet.
that person is going to read that blog and say, you know what, I'm buying this guy's book, because he's helping me through this blog. I mean, I'm so interested to see what he has to say in his book. You know what I mean? So to answer your question, I think, my strategy is just to be who I am, and I try very hard not to oversaturate. Yes, I'm marketing, and quite frankly, honestly, yes, I want to sell books. You know what I mean?
Well, you do have to pay your bills.
Exactly, and that's what that person said to me too. He said, when someone says that to you, it's almost like saying, well, when a doctor fixes your broken leg, he's taking advantage of a person who broke their leg. Well, no, I'm providing a service. If you're grieving and I make you feel better and I help you find your way to a place of peace and healing, then I've done something for you. I've provided you a service.
Yes.
So I don't feel that way anymore. And I think that people that know me, and I do speaking engagements and I'm interviewed all the time, I let people know that. It's like I'm telling you to buy my book. I'm trying to get my books into the hands of people that need it. And if I'm going to make a little money from that, then great,
Well, and look at all the work you've done to build your business, and it is a business. It's a wonderful, loving business, but it is a business. And businesses need to make money or they're no longer in business, and then you wouldn't be helping anybody.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I got 2 points. I was going to bring up the doctor idea too, is if you were a doctor and you wrote a book on how to cure certain ailments and people got well because they bought your book and used your advice, then what's wrong with that?
Yeah.
And what's wrong with being paid? It's no different than if you went into a doctor's office and paid them to fix you anyway.
Oh, super.
And then if you're able to actually make a living doing this, and again, you're not just selling books, you're actually out there coaching people, helping people, talking to people, and working them through this. Well, if you had to go work a full-time job because your book wasn't selling very well or your services weren't selling very well, that's less of you to go do all this stuff that you're doing for people. So, it's shocking that people can't understand that aspect of it, I guess.
I actually wrote an article for Writers Weekly because over the years, so many people have said, why don't you just publish my book for free? Well, because if I did that,
We wouldn't be publishing books for very long.
Yeah, it's I there's Gary, do you have any employees or contractors, or is it just you?
It's honestly, it's just me.
Okay. Yeah, because once we grew big enough, we were hiring employees and contractors and printers and everything else. And, and in the article, I explain exactly what it costs a publisher to offer all these services. So, and you're offering services. Yep.
Okay, so I think we kind of covered some of the marketing strategies we're looking at. What are the more narrowly focused targets of your marketing due to the nature of your books?
So I think I have several. So my social media presence has, of course, been my main focus when it comes to marketing my books, and creating a space where grievers could come for support has made it pretty easy to find people that need my books. So by creating the Facebook page, I've now created readers that want to read a book about grief. I also do speaking engagements, and I do book signings at those events. So I'm usually paid to do this. People pay to come to the speaking engagement, and then I also at the end have my table with my books, and they'll purchase like an autographed copy. And I do workshops, and I'm often asked to speak at hospice events and hospitals and senior living facilities, and I bring my books to all those events as well. And I think one thing that makes my books always relevant is that someone who's not grieving today may potentially be grieving tomorrow. So what I mean by that is, if you write a book, say you write a fiction book or whatever, you write that book, and once someone reads that, they're done reading it. And if that book is, science fiction, say, and you're not a person that likes science fiction, well, you're most likely like never going to buy that book. But with a grief book, I may look at, I may be on Amazon and come across Gary's, surviving grief book and say, well, I don't need to read that. But then my spouse or my mother or my child dies tomorrow, and guess what? I'm probably going to go back to Amazon and say, I remember seeing that book. And I need it now. So I guess my point is marketing a grief book in a lot of ways is I guess a little easy, because again, whoever's not grieving today is going to grieve tomorrow. And I'll give you an example. I have to say, like, when I started doing this, and I started working with Book Locker, I was very aware of the fact, and Angela, you made it very clear, I'm not helping you market this. Here's your book, off you go. And
Hey, I gave you that free 90 plus days of
you
promoting your
did,
book
and I'm gonna,
online.
you did, and I'm going to talk about that, because so what happened was, when that happened, I understood that. I thought, okay, hey, I had this book published, and that was what I wanted to do, and she's not going to help me, but she gave me this free book. Well, you know what? I read that cover to cover, and I always tell people come to me all the time and say, like, how do you do so well at marketing your books? And I'm like, it takes work. Like, you can't just publish this book and then sit back and say, go ahead, everyone buy my book. I mean, you have to put the work in. And so I read Angela's book, and word for word, and I took everything out of that I could and said, I'm gonna try every single one of these things she said. And I did, and it was very helpful. But I also think that you have to be extremely creative. You have to step out of the box a little bit. And so one of the things I did was a hospice approached me. Most hospice facilities here where I live, I'm sure probably where you guys do too, they do an annual remembrance service. And so they invite all the people that they had on service that lost a loved one to come to this annual event. And they just do, they honor the loved one. They usually have like a video that they run with like each person's loved one that passed, and they have like music, and they always have a keynote speaker. And I was going out to these hospices and saying, I'd love to be the keynote speaker. Well, people were thrilled to have me, And so I
Sure.
would go, and instead of saying to them, I charge X amount of money to come speak at this, because a lot of times I wasn't charging anything. I was just doing it out of the goodness of my heart. But then what was happening was, I said, well, you know what? How would you guys like to give a book as a gift? Because I had been to a few of them, and I noticed at the end they were giving them like a candle or a picture frame to put their loved one in. They were giving them some kind of gift when they left. And I said, how would you like to give my book? Well, they thought that was a great idea. Well, they're going to have 150 people attending. They're going to buy 150 copies of my book. So I try to look outside the box beyond what I learned from Angela's book, but also, finding these little avenues that help my marketing within my particular niche. And I think that's important. My niche, I've gone to funeral homes. Like I said, I go where the grievers go when I want to market my book, and I do that all the time. And I think that's probably my biggest marketing secret, is that I just go where the grievers go, and I go where I know people are going to need my book.
That's actually really good advice for any nonfiction author. Go where the readers of your book would be, and offer your services there. Now, the 90 plus days book, almost everything in the book is free. It's things you can do yourself for free. The reason we don't sell marketing services is because if you look at our competitors' services on their websites, it's a bunch of garbage that isn't going to sell books. And we could have jumped into that pool years and years ago and offered those services, but we won't sell anything that we know isn't going to sell books. I just, I'm just not that kind of person. That's just not the kind of business we run. So
I wanted to, yeah, I'm going to add to what Angie's saying is one of the big reasons that we're not trying to offer marketing services is, you know, every book is different. Gary, you've got a specific audience out there. You know, you're not trying to sell your book to the sci-fi bunch, you know, you have a specific target audience that you need to market your book to. There is no one size fits all marketing campaign out there. And what a lot of your other publishers are offering is we're going to tell 100 different places that you have this new book. Well, all those places don't care that you have a new
book. That's probably one of the biggest ripoffs is the press releases they send out to, you know, 1,000 email addresses, probably 999 of them are dead. And all those get filtered into spam anyway. So you're right, Brian. They offer these services, but it's one service that is not individualized for each book.
Yeah,
and those don't work.
Yeah, and so like you, Gary, you know, you wrote this book, and then you realized who needed that book, and you went, I don't want to say went after that audience, but you sought out that audience and you catered to that audience. In fact, you offered your services and help to these audience. And that's how you're selling these books.
Plus everybody loves you.
Well, yeah.
Because you're such a sweet guy. Well, yeah.
You are awesome. You are selling yourself to a point. Mm-hmm. People are falling in love with you, not necessarily the book. Now they love your work, but I'm sure, yeah, if you've got the right personality and you are connecting with people, they certainly want to, you know, read what you have to write. I'm going to read from one of your articles that you titled, If You Have a Story Inside You, Let It Out. And you wrote that for us back on March of this year.
WritersWeekly.com.
WritersWeekly.com. And you say, it's extremely rare for an unknown author to simply send manuscripts to commercial publishers and be offered a deal. Just be sure to do your research if you decide to hire a self-publishing firm. There are many out there that are just looking to take your money and offer tons of costly services you don't really need. Mm-hmm. Others are simply overseas criminals trying to get Americans' credit card and bank info. Well, Gary, thank you so much for saying something we've been saying for years, and we were kind of wondering if we were the only ones out there saying it. But to have one of our authors actually, you know, you've educated yourself to the market and everything, and even you understood that. You want to talk a little bit about how that kind of came to light for you?
Well, you know, I was shopping around. I shopped around a lot before. You know, it took a while for me to educate myself on all this publishing, publishing, mm-hmm, sure, publishing arena. And Angela can testify to that because I send her like 100 emails asking her questions all the time. But it's like, that's just the kind of person I am. Like, I want to know, you know, and in fact, I just sent Angela one yesterday asking her like, why is this happening? You know, I want to know because I've seen some of, I guess what you could call the ripoff publishing companies. And I see what they do. And you know, I see these, people come to me to mentor them, and I've had a couple of people come to me to mentor them, and I will say to them, like, you should go to BookLocker. Well, they don't give you this, and my publisher's going to, you know, do this big ad campaign and make all these posters, and I'm going to have book signings, and they're going to do them. And I say, that's great. So what are they charging you for that? Oh, it's only like $9,500. And they're going, you know, and I always say to them, like, do you realize how many books you're going to have to sell just to get back what you're paying that publisher to publish your book? Yeah. You know, and so that was what I was finding out, you know. And so when people come to me now, I always refer a BookLocker, and I'm very honest. I say, you know what? They're going to publish your book, and they're going to publish it like really damn fast. And you know what? There's going to be no thrills if you try to call them. You won't be able to. They only take emails. You know, I tell them everything about BookLocker, and I tell them, but in the meantime, they're not going to charge you an astronomical amount of money. And if you put a little work into it and you do a little of the marketing yourself, you're going to get your money back really quickly. I did, you know, and so if I could do it, anyone else can do it, you know, and so that's why it was important to me to stress that you really need to look into these people that are, if something sounds too good, it most likely is not
Oh,
true, you know?
absolutely.
And so, and I just see that. And trust me, I'm a huge reader of of Writers Weekly. I read all these articles that Angela puts out there about, you know, what different companies are doing what. And I was fortunate because a friend of a friend had published a book through BookLocker, and I said to her, like, you know, at the time, I said, I don't have a lot of money, you know, and I just need someone to do this book for me. I knew nothing about it, and she suggested BookLocker, and I went with them, and I had success 4 times, you know, and I thought, well, this is fine. But like I said, I do see these people that don't listen to me and take these book, you know, there's an author that that I was mentoring that is now doing like an audio of his book through the publisher, who are charging him like an astronomical amount of money to do that, and he's yet to even sell enough books to get back what they charged him to publish the paperback, you know. And I'm like, oh, these people are just taking your money, you know. It's
We
unfortunate.
do have packages that offer more services like editing and everything, but our $975 package, give it's print, ebook, ISBN barcode, full distribution. It's everything you need to get your book on the market. And I always tell people, if anybody quotes you $1,000 or more dollars, you and you just want to get your book on the market, that's all you need. Don't spend more than $1,000.
Yeah, I
And
agree.
some of these companies are charging 20, 30, 40,000. Oh, what was the guy? The big one, the fake book to movie deal. Have you seen those ads online? A guy contacted us. He spent $1 million over the past 2 years because they kept saying, "Oh, well, now we got to hire a producer. We need this much more money. We need this much more money. You're going to make so much money in the end." And it was a company in Pakistan that totally stole his money. That's the worst one we've heard of so far. Regarding phone calls,
I was going to touch on that, but go for it, Angela. Go for it.
Regarding phone calls, over the years, I have given my phone number to two authors. Now, this is my personal cell phone. We all have cell phones. We don't have business phones plugged into the wall anymore. Nobody does that. And to this day, those two authors contact me all the time. One calls me almost every day, and another one texts me, sends me funny pictures and stuff, and he lives in Texas, so that's okay. But one of them calls me almost every day, and he lives outside the country. It drives me insane. We've published more than 16,000 print and electronic books in the past 25 plus years. If I gave my phone number out to all authors, I'd have to hire 10 people to do what I do because I wouldn't have time to do any. I'd be on the phone all day, every day. But everybody gets my personal email address in case they need anything at all. And we have author accounts, and that's where most of the correspondence goes on. You log into your author account and it pops up. We've this dashboard. Every employee can see every message. Mason goes in every morning and labels it with different, you know, I think this one's for Allie, I think this one's for Justin, this one's for Angela. And so we can, you know, jump on those right away. The message you sent to me yesterday, I saw it right before we came on the air here. And I'm going to refer I already texted Richard, and he's going to contact you about that because he's the expert in the back workings of Amazon.
You know, I don't know if you want to talk a little bit about it now, but my question to Angela was, a colleague of mine has a book that, you know, it just seems to stay in the top 100 in the category of grief and loss. However, I know that my books sell a lot more than that particular book. And so my question to her was, do some publishers charge you to do something that keeps your book on that list? And I did a little research, and I think that it's true. I think there are publishers that have ways of making it so that your book, even if it's not selling hundreds of copies, that it's looking like it is.
That would not surprise me.
Yeah, I was
No.
just wondering if you ever came across that, you know.
I have not come across that, but Richard's researching that for you today, and he'll
Good.
get back with me and you about it. And he owns boostabook.com, and we sell his service to our authors, category and keyword research for specifically for Amazon. So he'll know what's going on.
Okay.
Yeah.
Before I go on to our next point, I wanted to make one other point about the phone call subject. Is one thing that, again, like Angela says, we have all of our authors, every communication goes through basically a messaging board, which we call the author dashboard. So never would you have a phone call with us and then something goes wrong and we would ever be able to say, well, we didn't say that. Because everything that you say to us and we say to you as an author is in writing. And you can always go back to, every author can go back in their author account and see exactly the conversation that was had. Because it's all typed out.
It really eliminates misunderstanding. Yeah, exactly. Also, the publishers that just throw their phone number, the foreign scammers we've been tracking, they all have that little chat bot at the bottom of their screen. And here's my phone number. Give me a call or give me your phone number. I'll give you a call. I've spoken to so many of the victims of those foreign scammers, and they say they can tell they're talking to somebody who's in call center.
A call center. Yeah.
Yeah. And they have very bad English. They're clearly located overseas. So if a publisher is, just throwing out phone numbers left and right, you're dealing with a call center. You're not dealing with an actual publisher.
Yeah. Okay, Gary, you also wrote an article for us talking about networking with other authors internationally, and I found that real interesting. Can you talk about your work networking with other authors?
Yeah, so you may have heard of her. There's an author by the name of Donna Ashworth. She writes poetry that's geared towards grief. I reach out to these people because her book is always in the UK. It's always like a number one bestseller on, we kind of have the New York Times and they have something like that in the UK. And so I reach out to those people, and I think it's important to collaborate. You know, I recently reached out to Gary Rowe, who has like at least 25 books on grief and loss. He's very well known in the niche of books on grief and loss. And I sent him a copy and said, could you look at it? And I tell them, you don't have to read the whole thing. You can just like skim over it, or, I know you don't have the time, but I would love to have a review from you. And some of them agree, some of them, you hear crickets, you don't get any response. But when they do that, it's really helpful because, people say, well, he's really good. And if he's saying the book is good, then it must be good, And so I think that's important. And I have a really strong following in the international market. I think on my Facebook page, the New Zealand and Australia and the UK, I have a lot of followers from those three countries, and they buy a lot of books, and so it was important to me to not just keep my marketing only in the US, because I knew that grief is universal, and there's people all over the world that are grieving, and they do truly buy my books from all around the globe, I wanted to make sure that I included collaborating with international authors and people in the field of grief and loss, as well as within the United States.
Well, I'm sure that you're also getting contacted by authors who want you to review their books.
All. I literally have a closet that just has all these books in it that authors send me and ask me, and my name is on the back. The thing about that, if you look at a lot of the grief books that are out on Amazon right now, my name is on the back, my review is on the back, so people now see me as one of the major voices in the field of grief and loss, and so they really want my name on the back of their book, and quite frankly, from a marketing standard, I'm happy to put my name on the back of your book.
Sure.
Because if they're going to read that book, they're going to see my name and my book on the back of that book.
That's great. Great idea.
Yeah.
Okay. Just got two more things here, because I know you got other things going on. I want to try to wrap this up within an hour here.
Yeah, he's got like 1,000 messages he needs to answer on Facebook.
He's in demand. And you did touch on this a few minutes ago. I just wanted to kind of revisit it for a second, let you speak to us. You do book signings, you hand out business cards. The creativity in the other venues that you go to is just, again, it's this great example of how you've kind of adapted to the niche of your book. You go to wellness centers, churches, funeral homes, senior centers, assisted living centers,
hospices.
These are all it's like, yeah, these people are going to deal with the loss of somebody at some point. And any other examples of places that are unique to your subject matter that you found successful in you know, marketing your books?
Well, like I said, it's mostly, it's mostly places where grievers will go. And I'm often asked to speak at places I've never even heard of. Like I just yesterday, I just got asked to speak at in the UK. There's a nonprofit that is three women that lost a child that got together and started this nonprofit for mothers that lost a child. And they asked me, if I would be a speaker for them, and do it via Zoom for one of their like widow camp kind of things. I've also been asked several times by Soaring Spirits International, who also have a Camp Widow all around the country, to speak at theirs. The only reason I don't do that is because they don't pay me to get there. And so I live in Massachusetts, and it's pretty expensive for me to like fly out to San Diego and spend, X amount of days there and in a hotel and all that. It's just not financially, viable for me to do that. Yeah. So it really all depends. A lot of times I go to places that I never even heard of, I guess is my point. People just reach out to me because they see me on social media or they read my book and they're interested in having me talk about that. But, I wanted to share one thing with you. Another thing too, for people that are looking for ways to market their book, is that it's really important to have mentors, And so for me, what I did was I did reach out to other authors and people that I knew had a lot of knowledge in the field of grief and loss and had books that were somewhat successful. In fact, one of the authors that's been a major mentor for me is from Canada. And I had reached out to her. Her name is Cori Serrata, and she has a book called Someone Died, Now What? And I was on YouTube at one point, and I saw she had done like a TED Talk, and it was just amazing. And it had like all these views, and people were viewing it all the time, and it was just a fabulous thing. And I reached out to her, never assuming that she would even answer. And then she did. And then, talking with her over email back and forth. And it was when my first book came out. And she said, I can help you, to market that book. And I said, well, that would be great. And she said, and then I'm thinking to myself, okay, this is Canada. That's great. She's going to help me up there. And so she ended up meeting me on Zoom, and we ended up like becoming friends. And she was my mentor, and I've done, video podcasts with her, and I've pushed her book, and she's pushed my book up there. And, so it's just been a great collaboration. But one of the things that she had said to me in the beginning when all this started, and, you had asked me like how I got into grief coaching and how I got into, doing groups and all this kind of stuff. She had said to me, Gary, think of your book as a calling card. You are doing the work you're doing, helping grieving people, and you want people to feel that you have some knowledge in this. And so a book is somewhat proving that. Well, he must know what he's talking about. He wrote a book about it, and I'm going to read the book. And, oh, yeah, I read the book, and it sounds like he really knows what he's talking about. And she said, so think of it as your calling card. That book is going to open doors. And quite frankly, it did. It opened the door to grief coaching. It opened the door to speaking engagements. And so I loved that advice. And so my point is it's really important. It was always important to me to reach out to achieve what I wanted to do, to reach out to people that were doing very well in what I wanted to do.
Yeah, and now you've got authors reaching out to you in the same way. So exactly. It all comes full circle, and all authors need to support each other any which way we can.
Exactly. And you know what? I always say that I'm very, very, I'm not, there are people, and I've reached out to them, and I won't mention their names, that, they've gotten just so famous, I guess, that they don't want to help you. It's almost like, I always say, like, this is not a competition. Like, we can work together and help each other. It's yeah. not like you don't want to help me because you're afraid I'm going to get more notoriety than you, or I'm going to sell more books than you, but there's people out there that are like that. And I'm not yeah. that kind of person. But that being said, I've also been burned. You know, there's been people that have come to me and said, you know, oh, can you help me do this? Can you help me do that? And they burn you. You know, they're basically just, you know, when you have a following like mine, a lot of times I can tell right away if someone is just reaching out to me because they want more followers. You know, and so I have to be really careful, you know, is this person reaching out to me because they genuinely want to help people? Or is this person reaching out to me because their book isn't selling well and they want more followers? You know, and that's not what I'm about. I'm about helping people that genuinely are doing this because they maybe had a loss of their own and they really want to help someone else. And I've gotten good at weeding them out, but in the beginning, when I was very naive, I was not good at it, and so I got burned.
Yeah, there's a certain level of vampires out there who want to jump on your coattails and hope that they can, you know, succeed from your success. And there is a certain percentage of authors that are very to suffer from snobbery. You know, they are so full of themselves. You know, I think that there's a high percentage of narcissism in the industry, seriously. And so yeah, I have also encountered people like that, the vampires and the snobs, and yeah, when marketing my books.
So, Gary, this is the last question here. You are actually one of our top selling authors.
Well, every month, because I sort the royalties. He's the top paid author every single month at BookLocker for months and months. It's
So
been
I
that
guess
way.
we got to call you our best selling then.
Yeah, you're our
Okay.
bestseller. Thanks.
Bestseller.
I'll take the
But you're the book is just a small part of everything you're doing. So you want to just if you want to kind of wrap things up by just explaining where the book sales fall in compared to all the other services, and I don't necessarily mean money-wise, but almost, I guess, a percentage of the overall business model that you're running.
Yeah, so I would say, you know, one of the reasons that I created Surviving Grief LLC, because I needed to make it a business. And it wasn't just really because of my book sales. My book sales were doing good, but because of the book, that segued me into doing other things. It started a new career for me, which, quite frankly, is with grief coaching. And so, grief coaching, you know, it makes more money than the books. And so, I also do speaking engagements and get paid to speak at those engagements. So, really, the book again was just a calling card, you know, to say like, you know, here's this book, but it segued. And I think that it's important for authors to know that, you know, if you're interested in doing something and you write a book about what you're interested in doing, that book can be, you know, a key that opens the door to that new career and new life that you want to create for yourself. And that's kind of what happened to me. I honestly never imagined I would be doing anything I did, and all of this was born out of writing my book, because when I wrote my book, I wasn't doing any of this kind of grief stuff. In fact, I wrote the book, and the only reason I started the Facebook page was because Angela said, make sure you have social media and sell your book on social media. And so that's why I started Surviving Grief, the Facebook page, and it took off, which was wonderful, and it helped book sales. But like I said, the book is what opened all the doors. And so if you have something that you're interested in doing in your life, a book can be a great way to start.
And under this episode, we are going to, on writersweekly.com/podcast, we're going to put links to all of your books, to your Facebook page, to your website, and I've been making notes throughout when we've been talking. Corey Serrata, Somebody Died Now What? We'll put a link to that, and several other things we've talked about. But anybody can go in there and go underneath the podcast. Click on the links to find your books and your website and ways to contact you. So, because you need more emails from coming through Facebook,
Not really, but okay.
right? But it's sweet that you're available and that you're spending so much time helping people. You're just an awesome human being.
Thank you.
And we're honored to know you.
Thanks.
But before we go, one more time, the name of the Facebook group is?
It's Surviving Grief.
Okay. And are there any other places you'd like to let people know where to find you?
You know, they can find me on Instagram. It's, again, Surviving Grief. They can find me on Twitter. Again, it's Surviving Grief. I also have a YouTube channel, and I think the YouTube people, anyone that's grieving, would find the YouTube channel really helpful, because there's all videos that I've done. I do what I call a Surviving Grief video podcast. And so it's a podcast where you actually see the person that I'm interviewing, and I reach out to different people. I've reached out to Sarah Ryan, who's a very well-known author, again, with grief poetry, and she has a bunch of books out. She has a huge social media following. All her posts go viral. I interviewed her, and I interviewed, you know, different people that have had different losses. So I've interviewed people that have lost a child, famous people that are doing something in the arena of grief and loss on that YouTube channel. So that's a helpful place that they can go and find me as well.
We will put links to all of those underneath this episode, as well as along with a link to where for Sarah Ryan, mm-hmm. so we can promote her book as well. Her books, great.
She will appreciate that.
Yeah,
great.
Well, and, happy to do it.
And it, just like you said, any other authors who are, you know, wanting to figure out how to, you know, get better sales and make a business out of what they're doing, just like the advice you took for yourself, they should look at what you're doing, mimic it as best they can. Imitate it. Find somebody that's doing what you want to do, being successful in the place you want to be, and duplicate what they're doing. Gary
also we'll put links. Gary has written several articles for Writers Weekly on book marketing for us, and we will put links to those as well.
Well, Gary, I really appreciate you taking time to sit in with us today, and we're absolutely proud to have you as part of the Book Locker family. You've done wonderful things, and we're not just talking, you know, sales and money. You're really making a difference in the world, and,
yep.
and we're happy to be any little part of that.
Yep.
Thank you.
All right. Well, that'll about wrap it up. We appreciate you, and take care.
Thank you.
See ya.
All right.
Bye-bye.
All right. Well, I enjoyed that.
That was great.
That was good.
What a great guy.
And I mean, just the idea of, you know, he started doing this, I guess, to, you know, he needed help for what he was going through.
Yeah.
And then he realized that he could help other people. And there's nothing I like better than seeing somebody succeed because they set out to help other folks.
Yeah, and think about how many thousands of people that he has helped. It's just amazing.
Yeah.
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 So, all over the world.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. Internationally. So, I mean, it's not, you know, it's not all about book sales and making money and all that. Sometimes, you know, just doing something to help other people. And if you get to, you know, reap some financial benefits from that, or even get to change your career to something you really love doing.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
What a blessing there.
When he said he sent me hundreds of emails.
Yeah.
Yeah, he did. but I didn't mind, because from the very first email, he just came across as a really, really nice person.
Yeah.
Really caring, loving, nice person. And I, you know, every time I get a message from him, I get excited, because he's so much fun to talk to. And he doesn't even send me query letters for Writers Weekly.
Yeah.
Whatever he writes, we publish.
Yeah.
Because he's got such great advice on marketing books. And mm-hmm. on his recent one was, he talked about how to add a workbook. Mm-hmm. So you can sell your original book and your workbook. So he wrote an article on how to do that. And of course, has workbooks on the market now. But yeah, super nice guy and really smart. Really, really smart. Knows a lot about his industry and knows a lot about book marketing now.
Yeah. All right. Well, could you perhaps be our next bestseller? Well, why don't you reach out to booklocker.com and find out. Find out what we have to offer. If you've got a manuscript sitting around that you've been wanting to publish, or you've just written a book and you're excited about publishing, but you don't know where to start, booklocker.com.
If you have an idea for a book and you want to run it by us and see if we think it'll sell, you can reach out to me directly. Booklocker.com, click on the contact us link, and that'll come right to me.
Well, that about wraps it up for today. We appreciate everybody listening. Please give us a 5-star rating if you like what we're doing, or hit that like button. If you're on YouTube, hit the subscribe button. That way you'll always be notified whenever we download or upload another episode for you to listen to. We're getting a nice little following on our YouTube channel, and that is phenomenal. We're very happy about that.
Yeah.
And we will see everybody next week on the next episode of the Writers Weekly Podcast. Bye, Angie.
Bye.
Thank you.